I want to live in a world where gender isn't a deciding factor in opportunity. Hey, it's Vanessa Paisani, and you're listening to Amplified, the show where we're changing the stories we tell ourselves about women, and as a consequence, about men too. Because remarkable women aren't a supply problem. There's just so many of them out there, and I believe we need to hear from them. So that's where I come in. We'll also be chatting with some men about the topic as well, because we want to hear their stories on this too, especially why this topic is more important than ever. And to you, thanks for joining us each week for great conversations with remarkable folks and believing that remarkable women aren't a supply problem.
Hello, and welcome to episode 3 of Amplified. I'm so happy that you're joining us today for a chat with Louise Odongo. I met Louise through a leadership development program that we did in Atlanta, Canada called 21 Inc. And Louise is a leader in so many regards. For her professional work, she's currently the manager of policy and corporate supports at Housing Nova Scotia. She's also a director with the Credit Union Atlantic, as well as she participated in the Governor General's Leadership Conference, which you'll hear her speak a bit about. I did want to note that our conversation took place a few months ago, so it was late summer of 2018. I was in a coffee shop, so if you hear a bit of background noise, that's what it was. My apologies. And I'll also say that as I was listening back to this interview, oh, so many takeaways. Some of the beauty of this interview, Louise talks about power and influence. Actually, Louise is the one that came up with the tagline, "Remarkable women aren't a supply problem." And she'll tell us a bit about the confluence of factors that helped her suggest it to the project. We talk a lot about systems, and one of my favorite things there is that there's no silver bullet, which I think the more and more work I do, the older I get, the more I realize that is how true that really is, how important it is to keep that in the back of our heads as we're doing some of this difficult work. And she talks a bit about some frameworks for having difficult conversations. So I hope you enjoy this amazing conversation with the great Louise Odongo. Thanks so much for being on the podcast today, Louise. And I was really looking forward to talking with you because when I first came up with the idea for the site Amplify, I reached out to you and you gave me lots of great feedback. And actually, you came up with the tagline, which I totally love, which is "Inspiring women aren't a supply problem." So I know you've been thinking a lot about diversity of perspectives and representation and that type of thing for a long time, which I think probably helped you come up with the tagline, "Inspired women aren't a supply problem." So I was wondering if you could maybe tell us a bit about how you came up with that and some thoughts that you might have on amplifying the voices of women.
I first of all have to say that it's really kind of a convoluted way of how the tagline came up, but it's probably a number of different conversations and a number of different ideas that were circulating in my mind and then experiences that I had pretty much maybe within the month of talking to you that all drove it. But a specific point in time or moment that I remember that I want to reference is I participated in the Governor General Canadian Leadership Conference, and Kathleen Taylor, who is the current chair of the conference, but at the time she was a speaker, and I think she had been a previous participant and maybe member of the experience. She spoke, and she was talking about diversity and diversity on boards. And really every speaker before her, the conversation around narratives and the stories we tell and the power behind the stories we tell and how we tell stories was this kind of a theme throughout the entire weekend of speakers that we had listened to. And when she came and spoke, she talked about diversity on boards, and she talked about whenever she has conversations about talent development and succession planning, whether on boards or in organizations. And she, I think at the time, was also the chair of the Royal Bank of Canada board, so quite a heavyweight of a lady. And she said that, you know, whenever people talk about diversity, the issue is not a supply problem. The issue is the policies and the recruitment style and the reach that people use to try to access the talent. And it was such a relief for me to hear someone with such power and experience and influence say that, because I was really sitting in that space after about a month of frustration about the conversation and how it's seemed to me to really be about how women can be more confident and put their hands up more and lean in more and all these things that women need to take on themselves, when I know so many amazing, powerful, talented, ready for action women that are not really in waiting and in training anymore. They're just not getting access to opportunities. So when she said that, and I actually spoke to her after that to get some advice from her, I told her how what she said really resonated with me and why, and she was really gracious about it, and she said, oh, no, I wholeheartedly agree with it. And I shared with her my frustration about the 30% of women on boards and why isn't it higher, why isn't it 50%, and so we had a good laugh about that. And so, yeah, when I was chatting with you, I think it was just the critical mass of all these different conversations that I've been having with people and walks that I've been taking and ranting in my head. And yeah, just it was finally the opportunity to say, you know what, let's actually be part of changing the narrative. It's not a supply problem.
Yeah, I love that. I know that currently you're working in the housing sector in Nova Scotia. And I read what you just said about structural issues, and basically maybe sometimes women aren't finding ways to access these opportunities, and I can imagine there's a similar issue with housing. So I know you think a lot about systems and how do we make system change. I was wondering if you had any thoughts on how we go about really digging into systems change when it comes to basically helping more women be able to access those larger opportunities, whether it's on boards or executives or starting businesses, like whatever it might be. How do we help people get there?
That's a really big one. And it's funny because I think I've always thought about this. So you referenced me working at housing. But so I actually have a master's in plant biochemistry, and I've always been interested. Even when I was studying, I'm such a geek, nerd, study, academic, love reading and learning person. I would always, even when I was like below the age of 10, think of things in like kind of systems and flowcharts and webs. And when someone introduced me to mind mapping, I was like, oh my God, someone just opened my brain and saw how my brain works. But at the same time, it's really big. So it's hard to think of, it's kind of interesting to me that we ask about systems and then the context in which the question is asked, we kind of, everyone has to give like a list of maybe 3 or 4 things, which is like antithetical to systems, but that's an aside. So to get to the how do we do this, I don't know. I think it takes everything and everyone. And because we're talking about shifting systems and structures that have been in place for a long time, I think it takes the big shifts and it also takes like the little drops of action. I really believe that. I don't know that there's going to be any one thing that works. I don't know who said it first, but I used to hear this when the One Nova Scotia report came out, that people would say there's no silver bullet. There's not a silver bullet. So I think there's not going to be the one thing. And I think when it finally shifts, we won't even be able to say what did it. I think it's just going to be all the little and big steps by people we would have expected and steps from unexpected places is how we would do this. And I think about it in terms of what's already happening with nonprofit organizations, with advocacy groups, with conversations in the mainstream media and publicly, and with who we know and define and think of as leaders. And then I think of it in terms of people that I would define as leaders that never are in the limelight or never get
their voice amplified, but that make significant impact and really influence a lot of people, even if they do it on a one-on-one basis.
Yeah, that's so true, isn't it? And do you think in terms of changing systems, is it important to see the system, like for people to be able to understand it, or are most systems so complex that at some level we'll never really be able to understand them?
I think that, yes, there's a level of complexity that we will never be able to understand, but I also think that as much as I love systems, and I've said what I said in terms of thinking that way since I was young, people don't interact with systems at a system level. And that has been something that I always kind of try to remind myself is, oh, you're going too fast and you're talking about too many things and the person you're talking to just thinks you're really enthusiastic and passionate and crazy. The personal is political, right? People don't interact with the whole system. They interact with it at the point that it affects them. And for me, if I think about the things that I care about, that's why it's really important. Intersectionality is really important. And understanding that the way I interact with the system and it's impacting on me is not the way the person on my left or my right or in front of me or behind me is, because it's personal and it's identity-based. And the way the system interacts with you is also personal and also identity-based. So I think that perhaps we can all heave ourselves a bit of a sigh of relief and not try to tackle the system at a system level, but look at what we can learn from those individual interactions and then what that says about some collective group interactions, and then and step from there. So rather than start from the largest possible, let's start from the smallest possible, but always consider that there's more than what we're working with. It's like that whole thing of how do you eat an elephant bite by bite, but you have to remember that it's an elephant that you're trying to eat.
I know. Yeah. I love that.
While you're going bite by bite, it's a pretty big thing you're trying to eat.
Yeah, it's not going to happen overnight. You commented a bit on intersectionality, which I really like. And in some ways, when I feel like talking about gender is hard at times, and really because it's placed in a broader context of different power structures that, as you mentioned, impact people in a very individual way based on their own lived experience. So it's curious, for you, when did you first become aware of gender?
I think, so I have probably several answers to that. I probably was aware of the male, female, man, woman, girl, boy dynamic and binary probably from a really early age. And when I began to notice that the things that I was able to do in the context of my home, where my parents really raised us very differently than their peers were raising their kids. And I'm going to generalize. I know that there's exceptions. Like people who know me, that know me from home, will be like, that's not true. So that's my disclaimer.
Yeah.
But very much. There was no really role. When I think of some of what I've read about what women experience and talk about, like the confidence and the not speaking up and roles being defined, etc. From a very young age, I didn't feel that way, certainly in the home. Like my dad, whether I have a sister and two brothers, we would, from as early as I can remember, over breakfast and lunches and suppers, my dad would buy the newspapers. He would buy all the three newspapers that we had at the time, and they would be on the tables. And you could talk about, as long as you could sustain your thought and your perspective and your argument about what you were going to talk about that was in the newspaper, you could talk about it. It didn't matter how old you were and didn't matter what gender you were, and we would just have those discussions. And when I was not at home and I would try to do that, and I would experience what I would experience, I was like, huh, something's different. This isn't how it is at my house. And even with around who was allowed in the kitchen or not allowed in the kitchen, and then culturally we were being told like what parts of the chicken that parents and children and men and women could eat and things like that. But inside our house, that wasn't the case. So that's when I first became aware of certainly like the girl-boy gender, was seeing how the way that we were being treated and shaped at home was not necessarily the norm everywhere. And then having to know what to do at home and what not to do at home so I don't embarrass my parents.
Yeah. That's interesting.
Yeah, and then as I got older and moved to North America and started to meet people that were really, you know, exploring their sexuality, and really, I think I started to meet people that were undergoing gender transformation surgery, et cetera, then I really started to grapple with, ooh, what is this? What is masculine and feminine, and what does it matter that boys want to grow their hair long? And then there was this whole conversation with Angelina Jolie and how she was dressing her kids. So that probably became maybe even more aware.
And do you think we still need to be talking about gender in 2018?
I think so. I think we need to be talking about all the things. Almost like anything that somebody says we don't need to be talking about it in 2018, that's actually the thing that I want to be talking about. Because I remember when Barack Obama was elected president, there was all these articles about how now we're in a post-racial America. And I do not think that anyone today will tell you that. They are still in a post-racial. So relating that to gender, I think anything that somebody asks, do we still need to be talking about this, is actually the hint that we should be talking about it even more, because that you ask the question is the point. So yes, I think we still need to be talking about gender in 2018. I think we need to include intersectionalities in the conversations about gender. And I also, because I'm from Kenya and live here, I would love a more global and also contextual perspective on many of the conversations that I read about or see people having. Like, for example, something that I'm always asking myself questions about is this conversation around millennials and the generation that, I forget what they're called, that's on iPhones and apps, et cetera, et cetera. I don't actually know how that translates outside of a North American or Western context. And yet so many decisions are made that way. But I don't know that the millennial generations is a global construct. So in addition to gender, and why we should keep talking about it, I also want to see how does gender and the conversations about gender manifest and interact globally, and millennials, and any of the other things that we really talk about from a very Western perspective.
How do you think we start to have that open and global, more contextual conversation? Because I think at times, like, I'm a believer personally that technology really helps connect people, and hopefully in the long run it will be a great equalizer. But at the moment, it does feel like it feels like we're at least seeing so many inequities. And so sometimes it feels really noisy or really difficult to have a productive conversation. So I'm curious for your perspective on how do we have those productive conversations. And it sounds like, I know the Governor General's Leadership Conference, you said you spoke about a lot of these things. I think you were there for a few weeks. And so, you know, how did you host those conversations, or how did you feel that they were productive? Did they move the needle? Did they help people grow? Like, how do we translate that on a more global scale?
You've asked like 10 questions in one. I love it.
I know, I was just gonna say that was very rambly, but feel free to take
that's
it.
Okay.
Read, like.
That's okay. I'm gonna try to answer it. Even if I don't remember all the ways you asked it. So I think that many of these ideas are big and they can be really overwhelming if you try to address all of them at once and think about all of them at once. And I'm not saying that we shouldn't be overwhelmed sometimes. I think that what we're talking about is actually really in a big deal to the people for whom it really affects and impacts. So us being overwhelmed is okay, because to be able to step in and out of overwhelm might actually be a privilege that some don't have.
Yes.
But at the same time, I think the Nigerian author said, you know, the danger of a single story. I think it's not, while there are some schools of thought that say, you know, you have to be operating at all levels all the time, I think that's a good, I don't want to say sentiment because it seems like I'm diminishing it. I think that's good to say, but is not always operational. But as long as when we're having conversations or in public spaces or in public debates, in seminars, in initiatives, in events, it's almost like having the sustainable development goals, but like for these conversations. So I think that it would be helpful if some sort of frameworks, and maybe they already exist and I just don't see them in operation, that really are like, behind this conversation we're having, this and this and this is a given. Even as we sit here in this moment discussing this, these things are a given, and how knowing these realities kind of come into the forefront or go into the background of what we're doing here now, we shouldn't lose sight of. I think that would be a more intentional and responsive approach that we could all take. I actually was saying this to somebody earlier in a different context, but it applies. Sometimes we build boxes and we create boxes for ourselves that nobody created for us. So allowing ourselves to open up those boxes, I think, is a way to move from narrow focuses or only being within our current context or not kind of looking at what's happening around us as well as what's happening between us and in the context that we're dealing with. And the way we had the difficult conversations, I feel like I have difficult conversations a lot, but sometimes it's to be there for the anger, because there can be a lot of anger, there can be a lot of hurt, there can be apathy. So to be present with that, to not be unwilling to engage. So if you're overwhelmed, yes, be overwhelmed and step back, but that doesn't mean walk away. Be overwhelmed, go recenter yourself, and then come back and be in the game. And be curious. So, and this one's a hard one for me. So someone told me that they were at a social work conference with Senator Wanda Thomas Bernard, and she said that, you know, she invites people to be curious about, and it could be about their anger, it could be about their reaction to being told something about white privilege, it could be about anything. So I have that in the back of my head. I'm like, okay, I want to dismiss what this person is saying. I need to be curious about why I want to dismiss what this person is saying. So that's how we were able to, and it wasn't pretty, and it didn't always work because, you know, people are people and human interactions are complicated. In the difficult conversations I've had with people, the conversations have been personal, but the conflict has not necessarily been personal. So that helps to come to the other side of the conversation. It's unfortunate when it does become personal and become personal attacks, because that's much harder to get to the other side of. But I think that's where we have to have grace for each other, because some of the structural problematic issues that we need to shift have been with us for a really long time and might not even change in our generation. So we need to have grace for ourselves for that.
I was curious what you said about, you know, conversation is personal, but the disagreement may not be personal. I can't remember how you worded it, but I really liked it. I feel like that happens a lot, in a lot of cases. Do you think the antidote or the way to get past that is that curiosity?
I think so, and I think greater self-awareness, or even what's it called, your emotion, your EQ. Mm-hmm. And I actually have a, it probably seems like an example that's completely outside of this, but I hold onto this because it still fascinates me what happened. And it's one of those, it's got a cliffhanger, like this new resolution for it. I don't know what the follow-up is. But so there's an annual women's leadership conference that happens here. And I've been fortunate, speaking of being given access, to have an invisible sponsor. I truly never know who puts my name forward for it or who pays for me to attend, but I've been going. And every year they have phenomenal speakers, and it's usually women who are either have been veteran leaders, so they've been sharing their tools of the trade, or it's women who've just stepped into leadership roles and kind of talk about their journey to getting there and what they're learning. But I've gone like 3 or 4 years in a row, and every year the presentations have been good. Like, you know, you learn something from everything, but they've been very professional, focused on, okay, now you're here. This is how to be. And it's one of those things where you don't really know you're missing it until it happens. But here it was. It happened, and I was like, oh my gosh, I've been missing this. So Kristen Williams from Junior Achievement spoke, and she talked about being a leader in a feminist organization and what that means. And she shared that, she gave the definition of what it means, and she shared that they're all women where she works, and many of them are mothers, and they're a diverse group of women, both in, you know, academically, culturally, age, multiple diversities are present. And she said, but they all understand that they want to do good work. They are achievers. They're action-oriented. They're committed to seeing their organization succeed, and their moms and their partners and wives. So because they're a feminist organization, they're intentional about the decisions that they make. They create a safe space to have conversations that people who I know who work with her have validated this for me, that they're able to have conversations at work that they've never had anywhere else they work with, and they don't really have anywhere else. It's a safe space to actually talk about what they want to do within the organization, and then also strategic shifts that they would dream for the entrepreneurial sector. And they also, without, you know, it being a huge issue, have flex schedules. If people need to come in late because they're dropping off their kids, or leave early, or relieve, do work from home because they're managing the family while their partners and husbands, who are also, you know, many of them are entrepreneurial and have to go do pitches in parts of the world. And she talks about, you know, and that they're willing to surface problems and deal with workplace conflict in a very different way than organizational models and the structure of organizational models are. It was fascinating, Vanessa. It was amazing. Like, I was just in utter, I don't know what the word is to say, and I was taking tons of notes. But here's the interesting thing. She was done, and there were almost no questions.
Oh, really?
And then, oh, I wish I was kidding. And then, what there were in a women's leadership conference, that really everyone in the room is a woman, there was like mansplaining in a women's conference.
Oh, no.
It was the most fascinating thing. And there was a lot of tension. And I can't remember what the points were that people were bringing up. But I was just kind of, I was like, wow, this is the first speaker that I've heard in my 3 or 4 years of coming here who's actually said, okay, so I'm a woman, and I'm a CEO of this organization, and it's a feminist organization, and this is why it's a feminist organization, and also these are the things we do. And I don't remember there were many questions for her. All I remember was there was a lot of yeah, but, yeah, but, yeah, but, yeah, but, yeah, but, yeah, but. So that I waited a bit, and then I put my hand up, and then I said, I just have an observation to make that it's really interesting that she just talked about her organization and the safe space and what that creates and what that means to her as a woman. And in a room full of women leaders, we are so uncomfortable with that. What is that saying? And that's why I'm telling you that it's a cliffhanger, because I truly don't know how the story ends. I hope the story doesn't end. I hope she gets invited back. I hope more speakers like her are invited back to the Women's Leadership Conference. But I'm telling you, I'm still fascinated by that.
And what was the response to your question?
I think the facilitator said, yeah, that's really interesting. And then we had to pretty much move on to the next speaker. But it was just really interesting.
Yeah, that is interesting, especially because you mentioned a bit about, in some ways, they're living their values, but also you mentioned that, so at JA, and I'm assuming this is JA Nova Scotia.
Yeah, this is JA Nova Scotia, Junior Achievement Nova Scotia, yeah.
Yeah, Junior Achievement. So they're basically working to build the entrepreneurs of the future, and in some ways embedding these values in their programming.
Yeah.
I've been thinking a lot about that as to how, and doing a lot of reading on social enterprise and how it's defined, and in some ways it does sound like you have to embed your values in the way that you make decisions and in the way that you live your work or your life, basically how you live your values. So do you think that was really like the first time you heard of an organization really and truly kind of living those values, or are you familiar with others?
I think that was the first time that I heard an organization living values that I truly would have thought were, everyone would have just been like, so speaking of your question earlier, should we still be talking about gender in 2018? I really would have thought that everyone in the room, and maybe that was my own naivety because it was a women's leadership conference, would have been like, yay, this is possibly the way of the future, women's organizations, and this is what it looks like. And yes, living their values of, yes, it's messy and yes, it's hard, but because we have called ourselves this organization, we are calling ourselves into the mess. I don't think I had heard, and I don't think I'd heard since then. And maybe it was the vulnerability and the style of the sharing and the pieces of the examples that were chosen. I don't know what it was about it, but it's interesting that I wasn't the only one that was affected by it. There was tension enough in the room that other people that were affected by it. But yes, I think it's difficult for organizations to live their values if their values seem to be nonconformist and a kind of are outside the status quo. It's like with social enterprises, you said, often the part of social enterprise that people talk about is really the money generation side of social enterprise, even though social enterprise is a continuum. In my experiences, the part that excites people about social enterprise is like, oh, so they're not just looking for charity. They're actually generating. Great. Like, that's celebrated.
Yeah, yeah.
It's like, no, but it's a social enterprise. They're generating social value. The social value part doesn't seem to be as amplified as the
monetary
the revenue.
Part.
Yeah. Revenue. The triple bottom line is heavily weighted on one of those three.
One of those three. I was speaking with someone a few days ago who was commenting on a similar type of thing, but she mentioned, she called it, she's like, you know, I was doing all of this work for so many years and I always had a social lens, but I didn't have the vocabulary for it. And she's like, finally someone gave it to me when they told me they were talking about the people-centered economy, which I really like that term because it still acknowledges that the majority of the world is driven on an economy of some sort, but then it's like, how do we also make this realistic to be people-centered? Because, of course, the economy is focused on people.
Yeah, yeah, like inclusive economies.
So I was also curious, what was your deepest learning from this past year, and how did you or how are you applying it?
This past year, oh man, the year is 2018. So this year I spent a lot more time inwardly focused and family and community support focused. And I've also experienced some loss recently. A dear aunt of mine passed away. And
sorry for that.
Yeah. But it's sad and you know, our family is grieving, but it's reminded me just how important social and family bonds are, however you define family, because for me, living so far away from home, I've got my blood family, I've got my family that I've chose, I've got family that chose me even though I didn't choose them. So I really loosened my definitions about many things, or my hang-ups. But just how important those social connections are and how it really changes, like, what really matters and what's really important. Kind of to your link about people-centered economies, it really moves you more from the transactional to the relational side of how we should operate. And that's probably been my deepest learning, is that my greatest resources are actually on the social support, people connected to each other, connected to myself side, when I often, because it's easier, it's more accessible, I know the skills I'm good at, definitions of success, reward and capture that, that's natural to be where I place my attention. But my deepest learning this year has been that actually feeding your soul and feeding your spirit and feeding your social bond is why you're able to be so effective in the places that you're able to be effective. And I don't think I ever have said that until just now that you asked me.
Yeah, that's a good one, isn't it? I heard someone this year describe it as we have physical health, emotional health, but also like social health. And that was the first time too that I had heard someone describe it that way. And it's like, how are you nurturing your bonds, whether they're professional or personal or both? Like, oh yeah, I really like that. And I heard someone comment recently about networking, which is obviously very important, but as a word has a lot of baggage. And his perspective was, he used the similar words as you. He said, you know, I think networking feels authentic or feels real when it's about building a relationship and it's not about a transaction. Awesome. Well, this has been really great. As an aside, actually, I spoke to another woman recently who also has a biology background, as do I, who was commenting, yes, on systems of gender and how they
all interact. Like everything is the glycolytic cycle, which turns out is also the Krebs cycle and it's also the brown fat. Anyway, yeah.
Exactly, right? It's so interesting that I guess as biologists we're trained to think in systems. It's like, it's just so interesting. Any final thoughts?
A lot of them. I think I would like to say that I'm very, very excited and pleased that you have, you know, followed your path and listened to your calling and launched Amplify and done what you feel you're supposed to do, which, first of all, that's commendable, because how many, particularly women, you know, step away from their dreams and focus on what we've been socially conditioned to do, and that you've called it Amplified, because I think there's a lot of voices that aren't necessarily given space to share what it is they feel they want to say. And I think that your platform and your vision and you as a, I think that you live your organizational values, I guess is what I say. And it really makes me happy to see that this is important to you and this is something that's possible. And you're just a really great inspiration and role model, I'm sure, to me and many others. There's a lot of opportunity that you have, not to put pressure and responsibility on you, to uncover those voices that won't necessarily enter the social media and tech spaces and forums, but that really have important, insightful things to say that audiences need to hear. And I hope that more people would get to experience what women are in Atlantic Canada and their voices that need to be amplified. And I'm really excited to learn about people that I don't know about, right? Because my reach and my circle is small. But I think, how many people have you interviewed so far? Close to 100?
Yes, on the site, it's been just over 65. And mm-hmm. for the podcast so far, you're the seventh. So, and I just wanted to say thank you for that. It has been, first of all, I'll say I agree that the number of people I've learned about that I didn't know about, like, oh, I knew there were just all these amazing people kicking butt in all kinds of ways I didn't know about. And
yeah,
and to that point, it's, yeah, I keep asking myself, like, who's not here and how do I reach them in different ways? And I am doing this off of the, you know, the quote unquote side of my desk. So I don't dedicate as much time as I would like, but it's been very rewarding. And I got to say, I couldn't have done it without you, because you helped me solidify the vision and how do I start it and keep growing it. So thank you for that.
You're welcome. You're welcome. When you were talking, I was like, you're my Earth astronomer. You're like finding and naming all these Atlantic Canadian stars.
Right.
It's kind of cool.
I know. And then I look to the future and I'm like, oh, where can we take it? Because then it's really about how do I go faster with this? Because, like,
yeah.
I feel like there's at least, I mean, a bare minimum of like 10,000 women that should be on this site, which is like 1% of the Atlantic Canadian population. And I'm like, 1% is probably barely the tip of the iceberg. And I'm only at 55.
Yeah. I think you can just hold that thought, because I think that it's going to grow exponentially, and it's okay that it's growing organically. And I won't be surprised if it's the women that you talk to and the women that you interview that will do it. Like, I there's no doubt in my mind that it's going to happen, just because I can think of all the fabulous people that I've read about on, that you've spoken to so far, and just how you're being deliberate about it. I have no doubt. Don't
Thank
be
you.
Anxious about how soon it happens.
I know, actually, on the deepest learning part, I feel like over the last 2 years, one of my mentors said to me, actually, he's like, you know, Vanessa, you don't have to live your whole life in 1 year.
I feel like someone needs to put that on a t-shirt for me.
I'm like, oh, yeah, right.
You don't have to live your whole life in 1 year.
Like, I need to get that tattooed somewhere. I need that.
Yeah.
It's hard, though. It's hard to have that tension of, you know, feeling like you have to make change and do stuff, and there's only, like, you only have such a short time here, but at the same time also realizing that, you know, it's a gift and you have to slow down too. Well, thanks again. I really appreciate it.
Oh, well, that was such a great interview. I'm so happy that you joined me for episode 3 of Amplified for this chat with Louise. I really like the idea that Amplify's goal is finding Atlantic Canadian stars. That really resonated with me. And I'm really grateful for all the help and the cheerleading that Louise has done for this project. Like anything, nothing is done in a silo. Nothing is done alone. And it's been so important for me to have these people who are there saying, I know why you're doing this. I believe in it. And let's build it together. So for that, I'm very grateful. I'm very much looking forward to having you join us for episode 4 coming soon. And thanks so much for joining us today. If you'd like to leave some thoughts on the episode, please feel free to do so over on the site, amplified.blog, and subscribe on iTunes and leave us a review. We'd really love to hear what you think about the show. Thanks again. And looking forward to having you join us for episode 4.